Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to Continued Success, a Phillies podcast that is part of the Good Fight podcast family. I am Justin Clue, assistant editor of the Good Fight, and with me is the managing editor of our fine Phillies website, Liz Rocher. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin. You
Liz,
know my name,
sounding,
right? You know it. That's my name.
Liz, you sound very well insulated at the moment. That's coming through loud and clear.
Yes, normally I've been podcasting in what I've been calling the podcast hut or the podcast yurt. I'm currently podcasting from underneath a blanket on my bed because that shit is so complicated to set up. I don't feel like carrying, you know, an empty shelf that we've been using in the kitchen into the bedroom to do this. So here I am under a blanket for your pleasure.
This is the like rogue street level podcasting you're tuning in for, folks. It's the level of professionalism you've come to expect from us, I assume. If you're listening to this, not only are you a good person and a rabid, frothy-mouthed Phillies fan, but you're likely a listener to Hit and Season, hosted by John Stolness, as well as The Dirty Inning, a podcast that takes a look back at some of the most forgotten, obscure, idiotic innings in Phillies history. And for those of you with $5 to spare, we suggest that you contribute to our Hit and Season Patreon so that you can receive extra exclusive content for subscribers every week from myself and John and Liz, and I guess Trevor too, but you know, what's he really do, to be honest? Let's be fair. I mean, he's a doctor, but like, whatever. So this week on Continued Success, we will of course be returning to our chronicle of the 2008 and 1993 Philly seasons, as they both celebrate anniversaries this year. But first, let's begin our quibbles with the current Phillies, who managed to again to the Marlins again, drop a series again last night. Liz, I assume that alarm was the talking about the Phillies alarm that goes off in your house, just like I have in mine, and it is just as grating and unpleasant as it is in mine. So
something
I completely
is on fire, I guess. Something somewhere around here is on
right.
fire, or I don't know. Something else bad has happened.
Something is on fire and something else bad has happened are both alternate names we considered for this podcast. So we decided to go a little less subtle, a little more subtle with it. But Liz, yeah, last night the Phillies dropped another series. They lost to the Marlins, a completely beatable team.
Because they're trying to kill me.
I mean.
And you and every fan. Paul Boye, who does the Good Fight Twitter account, his optimism is what I have at certain times. You know, I've been waiting for this as long as everyone else. I've wanted it as much as everyone else. You know, both him and I do this here in our spare time, do Philly stuff. And so this is, it's not a small thing to be in September. It is September 6th, and the Phillies are playing meaningful baseball. They haven't been eliminated. They're not close to being eliminated. Every game they play brings them either closer or farther away from the playoffs, as opposed to the games they play being completely meaningless. They could have stopped the last several seasons at any point in September, beginning, end, or even at the end of August, and it wouldn't have made a difference in where they were. So like I hate that this is how I am sometimes, that I'm so annoyed, because they really could do really well against the Marlins. I don't know why they don't. I don't know why this is happening to the Phillies, why we have to watch this, why we are cursed with this sickness of caring so much. But you know, the Eagles lose one game to a beatable team, it sucks, and you talk about it for a whole week. You know, the Phillies lose a game to a team they could have beaten. They usually don't just lose one, they lose two or three. And then they do that on a scale of 162 games. You know, they do that, you know, 20, 30, 40 games a year. They lose to teams maybe they should have won against. And it's like, this is now the only thing I can see forever, because all of those what should have beens. And, you know, we could be confident and worried about losing a lead instead of constantly angry that they are working so hard and failing to get back to where they were.
You know, I got a question for you. I have a couple, actually. You're talking about the Phillies losing to their division rivals that they should probably be able to handle at this
point. It's the freaking Marlins. It's the freaking Marlins.
I mean, these are teams that really have gone out of their way to – I mean, nobody's going to mistake the Phillies season as bad as things have gotten. Nobody's going to mistake the Phillies season for the Mets season this year. Or the Marlins, who had such an epically, just morale-wise for their fan base, terrible situation for their franchise earlier on. The Nationals, who released a statement pretty much saying, we're giving up on the season, we're trading away these key pieces. Other than the Braves, these teams, it's not just teams that they could beat, it's teams that are like, go ahead and beat us, it's fine. Like, we have accepted that beating us is what's going to happen to us, and that's fine. And they can't beat those teams, which is, I think, the even more infuriating part. And we'll get to take a more historic look at the Phillies and their divisional counterparts moving forward here. But I have a couple of questions for you here. Liz, at the start of this season, part of our optimism was spurred by how young the team was and how this wasn't a bunch of you all know the names of the free agents the Phillies have brought in the past 5 years. We don't have to cite that list again, but it was certainly not prospect after prospect. And even the young players we did see, it was like, oh, it's cool to see that guy up at the major league level. He's very rare was it that we were seeing prospects who had been at the top of a list that we were just, oh, we were so anxious for. A lot of the Phillies talent was simmering in the lower parts of the league or, you know, waiting to be acquired via trade. So when the Phillies finally, gave in and traded some of their higher named players and acquired young talent and brought up some of their young talent, that was kind of what this season was about. At the start of the year, that's what we were thinking. Like, this is great. They may not be very good record-wise, but we're going to see a lot more exciting young players. When they succeed, it won't just be like, well, I guess Mike Fontenot found the ball. It would be like, oh, cool, that player is learning how to do that. That's sweet. We're seeing some of this rumored talent finally executed on the big league level. We're seeing Nick Williams' power. We're seeing Aaron Altair's defense. We're seeing Roman Quinn's speed. Like, this was that's cool. That's what we've been waiting to see. There are only veterans really on the staff that were oft cited were Carlos Santana playing first base and Jake Arrieta on the starting rotation. There wasn't maybe another guy or two, Tommy Hunter, you could say, in the bullpen. But as far as like veteran presence, they were short on that, and that was fine. They had enough in the general view of things, and what we wanted to see were the young players. Now, since then, they've added Asdrubal Cabrera around the trade deadline. They added Wilson Ramos around the trade deadline. They added Justin Bour not too long ago. They added Jose Bautista even more recently. And it just feels like last night they used both Santana and Bour in an attempt to capitalize on offense, thinking that if they could get both those guys in the lineup, even though they play kind of, you know, the same position, if they could find a way to do that. And I hear you angrily sighing already. We all know how that story ended. In trying to put the most productive offense possible out there, they lost a baseball game 2-1. So clearly that was, you know, an idea, certainly one that didn't work out the way that was intended. My question is, by listing all these more veteran players the Phillies have acquired, have we sort of, without realizing it, started watching the kind of team we were so glad we didn't have at the beginning of the season?
Yes. As you started saying all of those things, I'm like, I know where he's going with this. I knew exactly where he's going with it, because they've largely, I mean, aside from a few, they've abandoned a lot of the kids and letting them do what they were supposed to do. I mean, this is what happens when, you know, even if you know you're playing with house money, which is what we've said a lot this year, you know, feeling, tasting, smelling the playoffs so close, watching the Braves continue to lose, you know, it feels like you can get it. You can reach it. It's so close. And they don't want to lose that. When you're so close, I get it why they're doing this. I just also don't think there were the right players out there for this team at the trade deadline, at either trade deadline, at least the ones that they were willing to pay for, the teams were willing to give up. And that's a function of the market. That's not something the Phillies can control unless they're willing to fork over more than they clearly were, because they're not stupid. They know what this year is. And so they've tried to add, you know, as much as they can while spending as little as they can, which is what they've done. But, you know, Jose Bautista has hit 300 for the Phillies in 6 games and 13 plate appearances. He's hit 300. I wonder how long that lasts. I wonder if he'll get enough playing time. And he could. He could get enough playing time for that to last, you know, for us to actually see if this is him. Like, it's been 6 freaking games. He started one last night. I think he started one other. Like, I don't want to watch him. I don't want to watch Justin Bour, who has a head and neck like a lump of unbaked bread dough. I don't want to watch Asdrubal Cabrera. I don't care how good he's been recently. I don't want to watch these guys. That's not what this year was about. This year was about the kids learning to do what they're supposed to do, everyone getting together and playing. And I think everything has gone to everyone's head. Mine, yours, everyone's included. There's no way to not, after being playoffs starved for so long, it feels like a dream that, you know, they've officially finished in a way, you know, the majority of their rebuild. It's their first year out there. You've got all these kids, you know, who've spent most of the year stumbling, even the ones that are more established, like Adubel Herrera. You know, they've spent the year stumbling. It feels like a dream to be like, God, the playoffs now? Yes, the playoffs now. It's not real. It's not real. I keep telling myself that the playoffs aren't real. Like, am I insane?
At this point, it has become very difficult to imagine, for me, the Phillies in the playoffs. And it's certainly difficult to imagine them having any sort of success if they were to get to the playoffs.
That doesn't mean I don't want them to get there, but no. It's going to be so painful to watch them get blown out in the play-in game. They won't even get to, no, they can't even win the play-in game. They're too far back in the wild card, I think, to do it. They would have to win the division, which means no matter what, we'll have to, you know, if that happens, we'll have to survive between 3 and 5 games of the game, most likely losing.
And that's something we've been saying more recently, is that, look, we can't even say there's a month of the season left. There's weeks of the season left. There's less than a month. Any success, we've entered deeply into miracle territory here. Any success the Phillies have as a team, any success that one of the struggling players has starting today, even if it's today that, like, there's a guy who steps in and has multi-hit games for the rest of the season, that's incredible, and the Phillies will win a couple more games because of it. However, it's a little too late. Like, the decisions on players based on their output this year, I mean, I don't know how much success right now it would take to make a dent in that. I mean, you know, nothing but like a little addendum, like, yeah, he was lost at the plate for 4 months and got hot for the season's final 3 weeks. That's not telling you enough to really come around on a guy. So in a way, you don't want to say, let's jump ahead to next season already. But in a way, it's sort of like this season is over for some guys. And I know specifically we've talked about that being the case for Adubel Herrera, which is a guy that we enjoyed seeing the success of so much earlier in the season, who seemed to be such a key component early on. I wanted to write a piece quoting myself from early in the season, in which I mentioned him as a potential National League MVP based on the level he was playing at. And he's gone. He's been a ghost for so long. And it seems as though the Phillies are with Roman Quinn in the picture moving forward in that department. I mean, you know, who knows what the future holds, but with less than a month left in the season, the Phillies need a series of miracles that don't really tell you that they would necessarily deserve to be in the playoffs, even if they did make it. They're just, unfortunately, at the moment, for whatever reason you want to pick, not a good enough team for that. And I think a lot of people, not mathematical elimination notwithstanding, I think you're just seeing a lot of that. And it's disappointing because of the point I mentioned, that instead of watching young guys make mistakes, we're watching Wilson Ramos slowly get thrown out at third base because his hamstrings are very bad. and he cannot move that very fast. You know, that's not what the season was about. And I kind of, without me realizing it, became that in this season's final month. It was like, wait a second. Jose Bautista's batting third. They got us again. They're 2015-ing us, and we didn't even realize it. That's absolutely, I commend them, honestly. They really snuck that one by me. Because you kept thinking like, oh, well, we still have this young guy, and can't wait to see this guy. But we can, okay, there's like a Cabrera. Okay, he's going to get some time, fine. Oh, Bautista, I guess they got to find a place. And a Boer, well, we need his power in this. And then next thing you know, it's like, wait, there's like five 32, 33-year-old guys in this lineup, and none of them are hitting. Like,
if you want to spend the rest of the season watching Jose Bautista, get out. Just stop listening. Seek help. Stop listening right now and turn your car around or leave your house and find the closest place you can check yourself in for observation. It is Jose Bautista. He has a glorious beard. The rest can go.
He has the best bat flip in baseball history. But, I mean, the story, I mean, I don't want to sound too conclusive here, but, I mean, like, the baseball story is winding down for Jose Bautista. He's not somebody you got to figure out. If you're figuring out Jose Bautista, it should be on a much shorter term than, well, let's see if he can pull it together in September. And maybe, how old is he? You know, and maybe he can play, be a role player on the team next year. I mean, that's just not something. There'll be other equivalents. Like, the older you get and as your skills diminish, the pool of players that you are a part of becomes wider and wider. There will be other chances to acquire a guy. Like, it doesn't have to be Jose Bautista. So we don't have to sit down and monitor Jose Bautista scientifically to figure out what he's about. I think you can kind of get the gist of it. That leads me to my next question, honestly. And I don't know. I think this might have popped into my head while I was sleeping. It's not like it's super creative, but it occurred to me it's something that you could feasibly ask right now. I don't know. I feel like a lot of people jump to a particular answer to this question, and I'm not convinced it's the answer, although, well, we'll see in a second. So obviously, let's assume you're in charge of what the Phillies – well, not in charge, but you're in charge of basically like assembling the Phillies next season based on what the owners tell you to do. And they kick your door in and say, all right, look, whatever we were trying to do, it didn't work. This rebuild is getting rebuilt. And this season has really slipped out from under our feet. Obviously, we're keeping Aaron Nola. That's fine. If they only let you keep one position player from this roster to be on the team next season, who would it be?
Oh my gosh. Position player, you say. I feel like the popular answer is most definitely Rhys Hoskins.
Yeah. But I think that would be the popular answer as well. And I'm not convinced that it's the right one. I don't think it's necessarily one, but
I'm just trying to, but here I'm looking at the roster right now in my head. The guys that they have, like I could, like Nick Williams has made some incredible strides forward this year, right? He's made some great strides, but I don't know if he has the ceiling of Rhys Hoskins.
I agree with that. Yeah, you know, I don't know what his ceiling is, but as far as being a development year, he did what he was supposed to do. He took some strides forward. He had some poor spots. He had some rough stretches, but he would make corrections and adjust and become a better Major League Baseball player from it. And that's what guys were supposed to do this year. Rhys Hoskins did a lot of appearing in a big way, then disappearing. And then he broke his jaw and he came back and he was hot as hell. And now he's tapered off again. And he's been an absolute non-factor right in step with Odubel Herrera for what, over a month now? He's not been the hitter that we want to see out there. And someone said like, look, with Rhys Hoskins, you're either getting I don't know who's a great. You're either getting like a for some reason I can't think of a prolific hitter in baseball today. I don't know. Josh Donaldson keeps popping into my head, but you know somebody on that level, all-star Josh Donaldson level. You're either getting a guy who mashes on a regular basis, who even when he's not hitting well is still hitting, or you're getting like a Pat Burrell, and both of those guys can be on your team, but they also change the outlook of the team moving forward as far as who they're going to acquire and who they're going to be after. So Rhys Hoskins, as far as like, if you could only keep one player, it doesn't necessarily have to be him. He's not the go-to answer. I would have been going back to Odubel Herrera. I think he's versatile enough that he would have been a great player to build around. He's disappeared more than Rhys Hoskins has. We know that for sure. So,
well, and I was just going to say that, you know, Hoskins, he needs to learn what to do to get out of slumps. He's been in the majors for just over a year. And he still has a lot of learning to do. He has to figure that out about himself. So there's time. Odubel Herrera has been in the majors for a while. He's been in the majors for quite a while. And I'm really discouraged and disheartened by this long, long slide. Oh, God, come back to us.
Yeah, that's why I keep circling the answer of Roman Quinn as far as a player to keep for next year. I mean, look, you, obviously you're jumping to, what, is he the best player on the team? No, but he's also he's on a learning curve that the rest of that a guy like Odubel Herrera, who's been in the league for so long, isn't on anymore. His speed is a much greater asset than anybody else on the team. And at the end of the day, that might be why I'm choosing him, because that speed, that's not going away anytime soon, barring, you know, outside forces. And he's young. So you can learn to make that work. As far as like Rhys Hoskins hitting home runs at a historic level, clearly that can go away at any time. But Roman Quinn's speed isn't going anywhere. So as long as you can coach him to use it more effectively, which is like the point of him being in the major leagues right now, then he's got the potential to be a more effective player moving forward. I don't know. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think he's, you know, every team struggles to find great bench players. And if this rebuild is being rebuilt, presumably it means, hey, we're going to play everyone at their natural freaking positions. Which means Roman Quinn is even more valuable, because you're going to need a guy as opposed to every other guy you have, but you're going to need someone who can play multiple positions. You know, he's toolsy. He runs fast. That also helps his defense. You know, I care that he is not that great of a hitter, but having legitimate speed opens up doors. Like Billy Hamilton is successful. You know, he's not a great hitter, but when he gets on base, you can't stop him because he's fast. And that's, you know, it's a different type of baseball that the majors is abandoned. You know, the majors is largely abandoned that type of baseball. Well, it's sort of alive and well in college. I love watching the College World Series because it's real sort of old school. I hate using that word, sort of old timey, station to station, you know, hit and run type baseball. You know, and I think the more that the Phillies open themselves up to playing that type of game, the better off they're going to be, because they're just playing the same game that everyone else is, but they're not playing it as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like the less, I'm trying to figure out how to suggest this, but like you're saying that's not the way Major League Baseball is played as much anymore. And if that becomes even more of the case, that's whatever people aren't doing, it seems like the kind of area that somebody like Gabe Kapler would try to use. You know, if people aren't doing this, if people aren't paying attention to a certain style or a certain strategy, that's where a guy like Gabe Kapler is supposed to jump in and think, okay, well, if they're not paying attention to this, and we've got this weapon in Roman Quinn, then like we can start doing this part of the game that people say has disappeared. And you know, if defenses aren't as sharpened to combat this, then this is an area where we can have an advantage. So I don't know. It feels like the equation could be drawn up pretty easily with the right pieces in place to capitalize on a situation like that. So, you know, but again, we're down to just having a couple of weeks left. So, well, we got to be careful because this can.
Man, where did this season? Unravel
into who cares? Just baseball. There's bigger things to worry about pretty quick. So, yeah, what happened? It's almost mid-September. That's pretty, yeah. Well, Liz, one more thing before we get to our this week's history lessons. But I'm going to read you a tweet. I want you to guess what team it's about. telling you who tweeted it might give it away. it's just inexcusably sloppy ball from a team nominally still going for it.
One more time.
It's just this is someone reacting to a play they just watched in a baseball game. It's just inexcusably sloppy ball from a team nominally still going for it.
Is that the Cubs?
I don't know. The Cubs have been playing pretty non-sloppy ball lately. I should have asked this at the time.
No, they had. The only reason I suggested that is because Sahada Sharma from from The Athletic, I think the Cubs played a real shitty game recently. They lost 11-1 to someone. I can't remember. It was a few days ago, and I remember someone or he tweeting something about that. Inexcusable and sloppy were in there.
Well, that's going around then, because this was a tweet by Brandon Golowski, who covers the Mariners for The Athletic. And
oh God, I completely forgot the Mariners existed.
I bring this up because it's not point by point, it's not player to player, and I certainly haven't broken it down that way. But there's an argument to be made that the Seattle Mariners are the Philadelphia Phillies counterpart 2018 season wise in the American League. And I think this is a kind of season that Mariners fans, based on what I can see, are more used to. The team like keeping them just in it and then breaking their hearts and just having a lousy time in the second half of the season. The Phillies had a season similar to that. The Mariners got really hot in June. The Mariners went 19-9 in June. They went 18-11 the month before in May. They had a winning month in April too. They went 15-10, and so did the Phillies. The Phillies never had single digit losses in any month this season, but they were certainly much better. 15-10 in April, 15-11 in May, 13-14 in June, and then they got hot again in July, went 15-11. But the Mariners kind of swung real hard in June, went 19-9, and then went 10-13 in July, and then they went 12-16 in August. So they seem to have like had a little more dramatic of a curve. But it's tough not to see the similarities there. And I saw that tweet last night and was like, he could easily be talking about the Phillies. Now, I bring this up because the difference between these two teams is that we have continuously seen all season long from all over the place, from fans, from media, talking about that, like the Phillies, there's an environment of positivity fostered by Gabe Kapler in the clubhouse. And when the Phillies were winning a lot, it was like, this is working. And the only grumbles about it were they were infrequent and easily cast aside. And now that the team is losing a lot, you're seeing more and more of them, seeing talk of participation trophies, and that is like a burn of some
kind. Pure morons, right, who have no idea what they're talking about.
And we talked about this on the last episode, so I don't want to fuck the chicken the way that the people who are talking about this are fucking a chicken. fucking the chicken of using the idea of participation trophies in the Phillies clubhouse, and how if Gabe Kapler would just criticize his players in public, everything would start to turn around, or at least I guess hold them accountable is the phrase. Which again, we don't know if he is doing that or not behind closed doors, or the argument being what is the value in doing so in public. The difference is why I bring up the Mariners. The Mariners recently had themselves a brawl in the locker room. The Mariners, I forget, it was either D. Gordon or I think it was D. Gordon, went up to members of the media and said, like, excuse me, could you guys please step outside for a moment? And they were like, absolutely. And they went outside, and like 2 minutes later, the doors flung open as like there was a big brawl. People were shouting. I think the people who factored prominently in it were Gene Segura and D. Gordon. And obviously,
I love that D. Gordon called off the press too, because he was about to have a brawl with someone.
Isn't that
so cool?
I
actually thought he was acting as sort of like the third party. Like, I think a brawl's about to go down here. Why don't I get everybody out of here? He's like, no, I'm about to try and punch someone.
Isn't that
get
so
out.
Cool?
I love D. Gordon so much. I love D. Gordon. He's one of my favorite players.
It's very smooth. The problem is that this was, pretty obviously this got covered. So it's very high profile. You could view this later after the dust settles and nobody's hurt and, everybody's like back on the same page. This was covered about a day ago. So you could look back on it and think like, all right, this is the team blowing off steam. This is a frustrated group of guys who maybe are taking it out on each other, some frustration, and hopefully can come back and use this as a learning experience, use this as a turning point potentially for the season with as little time as they have left. Well, Liz, you might say that if this was a brawl meant to turn the season around, it didn't succeed. I mean, the next night they went out and I believe they lost. And the people who figured prominently in the brawl were committing errors, were at the center of mistakes that cost them the game. If the intended effect was to really light a fire under their asses, it didn't really work. So as a comparable team to the Phillies, as far as frustrations go, win and loss wise, I don't know. Is this good evidence that perhaps a high profile moment of shouting and physical altercations and that sort of old school pressure release valve releasing, is this an example of that, maybe not working?
It could be. I don't know. You can draw your own conclusions. But I will say one thing about the media being angry that Gabe Kapler isn't doing what he wants them to do. Remember back last year, the year before, it could have been at any point during Matt Harvey's tenure at the Mets, but he at one point just refused to speak to reporters. One game, maybe two games, he would do that periodically. And you would get indignant tweet after indignant tweet from beat writers, from mostly Mets, but sometimes both sides, about how could he not speak to the media, just anger. The media is typically more angry about stuff that is preventing them from getting what they want. And I feel like people are frustrated at Gabe Kapler because he will not name names, throw people under the bus. He won't do any of the trite buzz phrases that everybody uses. He won't do it. He's just not going to be that type of manager. And they feel like it's dishonesty. Or at least some of them do, not all of them, but some feel like it's dishonesty or it's proof that what he's doing isn't working. Like, no, you're just angry you're not getting what you want. And so now you have to create controversy. I will not name names, but come look at my Twitter feed if you'd like information on whoever this pathetic idiot is. But they're just creating the controversy because they're not getting what they want. Gabe Kapler's not creating drama. So...
You never know what's
going to themselves
get under someone's skin or make something click in their brain or make them, I don't know. You never know what's going to turn a season around. And it goes player by player. Like they obviously have to change as a team, but that comes from making decisions on an individual basis. And you never know what's going to work as far as a motivation goes. And that's part of this team's learning process this year. There are certainly teams where a clubhouse brawl or the manager calling out his players in public might have an effect. That's certainly entirely possible. There's other cases where those things can happen and then the team succeeds, but it actually has nothing to do with that. It has to do with something else. But, based on what we see on the outside, that's what we decide made the change. And then there's cases like the Mariners where they can have a giant clubhouse brawl and it has really no giant effect on the rest of the season other than it does a good job of covering the news cycle for a day or two. So at the end of the day, there's just a lot of X factors in play here. And that's what we've been saying. The Phillies, that's what they've resembled all season long, really, is that they're loose in that they are relaxed, but they also feel loose as far as like they're not an efficiently running machine. There are a lot of wobbly parts to them. And part of that is the management. Part of that is how they're run and the experimentation that goes into that. So look at the lineup. There has been the same lineup, five times this season? And it's early September. So there's not a lot of stability, consistency. There's not a lot to lean on as far as this team goes. And I think that goes with the way they learn things, with the lessons they receive as well. So, it's September. Live and learn. But that's kind of where we're at with this season. But this season, we don't have to talk about this season. We can, now that it's been half an hour of talking about this season, we don't have to talk about this season. We can talk about a much more fun season, the 2008 season. Liz, remember that? Remember that 10 years ago? Remember that season in September when we were watching competitive baseball, but not necessarily feeling compelled to, tweet about it? around early September 10 years ago. The Phil's biggest foes were not a 22-year-old Marlins starter who hadn't made an appearance since June like they lost to last night, or a Braves team that wouldn't stop handing them opportunities to move forward in the division, and then the Phillies just don't take them. No, their biggest foes in the division were our favorite boys in orange and blue from the only town in New York named after what a toilet does. Liz, the Phillies have had a historical amount of trouble beating teams in their division. I mean, there's truth to that, and then other seasons, you know, obviously, you know, it changes season to season. It just seems like a specific point of frustration, especially this year, especially to these beatable teams in this division. But the 2008 Phillies, they did their own bit of struggling against their divisional rivals at this point in the season as well. They were entering a stretch where they were playing 9 games against NL East teams right around now, and obviously it was a different NL East back then. The Nationals were the bottom dwellers habitually. There was not much to enjoy about watching them if you were a fan of the Nationals. They had guys like Tim Redding and others. John Lannon, there's one. I believe this was Nick Johnson time. Ryan Zimmerman was, of course, there because I think he has always been with the Nationals, even before they were a team. But this was not a team. This was a 102 loss team in 2008. So the Phillies started September. They were 2 games behind the Mets in the division. So they had 75-63, but they had a series in Washington. They were heading down to play, and they dropped 2 of 3 to Washington, to the Nationals, of course. This was a year when they went 41-31 against National League East teams, and they went 12-6 against the Nationals and 14-4 against the Braves. But this series, of course, was not, you know, right when they needed to start racking up wins that were critical to the season. Yeah, that just wasn't going to happen. In game one, Kyle Kendrick gets battered in a 7-4 loss. In game two, they managed to beat John Lannon, which is a guy that, I mean, if you want to talk about, you want to talk about it, one situation where the Phillies definitely win, it's playing this era Nationals team with John Lannon on the mound. That I think is the best. You know, I know every time you want to think, oh, the Phillies can definitely win this game, you know, that's just a dangerous thought. But I feel like if there's one absolute scenario in the history of Phillies baseball where you could say, I 100% know they're going to win this game, that is the case. I feel like he is the opposite of a stopper. He is a letter goer. He is a run me
over. The opposite of a stopper. He is an open hole leaking milk out of the carton.
In game three, the Nationals broke a 5-5 tie in the eighth by sending 9 batters to the plate, blasting relievers J.C. Romero, Chad Durbin, and Clay Condrey. Eric Bruntlett started in right field. Jason Wirth started in center. Wirth actually played all 3 outfield positions in this game. Was Gabe Kapler running this team? Of course not, Liz. He was playing for the Brewers at this time. I mean, I don't remember Charlie Manuel moving players around a whole lot back in this era. There wasn't a lot of experimentation,
nope.
I guess. But when you think about, I don't know, I mean, would you agree? Like, this does seem obviously more like something that Gabe Kapler would do. First of all, Eric Bruntlett getting, you know, playing time, and then also just like putting guys different places. I feel like Charlie Manuel had like a definite idea behind that, but I don't know. I mean, would you agree with my assessment that that there's a possibility that a lack of lack of consistency is a problem, but just a lack of I'm thinking stability, reliability that has left this team a little less tight than they should be moving forward, and as they keep adding new parts, as the aforementioned as Drubal Cabrera and Justin Bour, that things have gotten even more unwieldy as the team has entered this home stretch?
I would certainly agree. You know, as much as I got annoyed at, you know, the same lineup every day, you know, you weren't so annoyed when the Phillies were winning all those games. You know, now, you know, I'm getting what I want, sort of, I guess, a little bit. Not really. He's moving guys around, but it's still guys playing in positions where they shouldn't. And that's the crux of everything. The Phillies set themselves up to lose this year. They set themselves up to be almost exactly where they are, if not worse, because they decided that it was time to sign a first baseman when they already have one and sign a second baseman. Yep. It's sign a second baseman when they already have one and put him at shortstop when they also already have one. You know, granted, Crawford was out for almost the entire year. I think he's played 34 games. And the majority of those came at the beginning of the season because he was only back a week or something when he got hurt again. And that alone set the Phillies up to have a lot of instability because like, yeah, Gabe's like, I'm ready. I can do this. I can juggle everyone everywhere and it will be fine. It will totally be fine. And whether or not he could do it isn't really the point. Whether or not it should be done is the point. You know, he may have actually accomplished it, but it doesn't seem to really be working. If only because I don't know if it could have ever worked. Could it have ever worked?
I mean, isn't the idea of trying different lineups to find one that works? Or I mean, I guess if he's addressing each pitcher, each game, each stadium, each situation with like, okay, what is tonight's lineup going to be? Then I guess no. The answer is no. That's not the point. And maybe that's why there was such a conversation about, well, why didn't he use the lineup from last night? That lineup worked when they scored 8 runs. I guess it's because every day, I would guess, just brings a new, you know, brings a new sunrise and it brings a new lineup for Gabe Kapler to determine. He's looking at a whole, you know, we see, okay, it's just game 2 in the same place against a different pitcher. I'm guessing, you know, whether it's a strength or a weakness, he's looking at a much more zoomed in view of that and just seeing a lot more numbers, a lot more factors, and has the, you know, introduces the potential to overthink things. And that's why you see a whole new lineup seemingly from scratch almost every night. I mean, that is a huge number of different lineups in a single season. Like, it is a lot.
And while other teams have used other more lineups, something I don't think we'll know unless someone actually looks at all of them, how different really were they? Switch two guys around, you know, or this guy comes into play for this guy because this one needs a day off. How different were the Phillies' everyday lineups from some of their other ones? Like, what, like, the degree of difference might be different. And I have no data, no information. I barely even have an assumption about where the Phillies lie in that. But it's a question that I've had, you know, and it shows that the goal isn't to find a lineup that works. Gabe Kapler has said time and time again, he wants all the information as humanly possible before he makes a decision. And so that shows me that the decisions he's making are all based on whatever data he's looking at. All the data, none of it. It's not about gut feelings. It's not about letting a lineup work. It's not, or that's a dumb way to put it. It's not about putting a lineup of guys together that work well together and putting that out there every day, the way Charlie Manuel was able to do it. Granted, you know, and you can look at the difference in the caliber of team, maybe because Gabe Kapler is certainly working with a you know, an assemblage of lesser pieces, at least on the whole, than Charlie Manuel had to work with. You can argue that his, you know, strategy of putting lineups together based on who's doing what every day, you know, is a way to combat that. That's, you know, what he's looking to do. But I'll also say he either needs to go all the way or back all the way out, because he's doing a half and half thing where like the same guys are in 3 positions and then everyone else is sprinkled around, you know, guys are in, guys are out, you know, they're up, they're down. So like, I want him to pick a way. If you're going to do it based on matchups every day, then do it. But then stop putting Cesar Hernandez at leadoff because it's not working because he stinks right now. You know, stop. You know, that is what would make sense to me. And I think that's what was irking me earlier in the season. You know, he wouldn't move Hoskins from that spot that everyone else could be moved.
You know, I'm now just wondering, based on what we're talking about, how can you even tell what worked and what didn't if everything is based on a single game sample size anyway? You know what I mean? Like, if he puts together a lineup that is to capitalize on the offense and then the Phillies go out there and lose 2-1 like they did last night, how does he know it didn't, you know, like if they had scored 8 runs, is it because they put that lineup out there? Or if they don't, is it because, like, what is that? Because, that's definitely not going to work next time we try it. Are they not going to try it again? You know, when things are just, it's like the blink of an eye, how can you really be sure what happened, I guess, is my question.
I mean, my impression from Kapler and the things that he said is that he's sound in his methods. He doesn't believe that there's a method issue, because he's, you know, he said just because we tried something and it didn't work doesn't mean it's a bad idea, which is true. It's entirely true. It's 100% true. But I think I wish there'd be a little bit more thought about method. You know, I feel like as he really wants to try the opener, which I think is both anti-labor and an idea that sucks the fun and life out of freaking baseball. That's something that no one's talking about. The opener sucks the life out of baseball.
How bad do you think he wants to do an opener? I think he wants to do it so bad.
He talked about it. He talked about it at the BP event, and I don't think I saw him answer. I mean, he had answers right at the ready for everything. The guy, he's very good at talking to crowds. He did not answer faster to any question other than the one that was asked about whether or not he wanted to try the opener. Yes, he wants to try it. He wants to try it real bad. But he's also keeping fans in mind, and fans don't want it here. Fans are not into it. I am wondering how long that keeps him from doing it, because he wants to do it so bad. And I'll say this, I don't want to watch a baseball game that uses the opener. And I think more people need to be talking about that. Because while the anti-labor argument is persuasive, it's also a little hard to latch on to. I think at a time when baseball is looking for reasons for people to love it, and the opener is a reason not to.
Yeah, I think if the Phillies get knocked out mathematically, I think you see a game where they use an opener. I think I could see that happen.
Yep, I think so. It'll give me the perfect chance to write about how the concept of the opener is essentially, I mean, I would call it anti-baseball. It's pro-winning, but it's anti-baseball. And I think that's a distinction that needs to be made. And I don't know if there's a way to prevent the opener from happening, because I don't know if it's right to legislate baseball that way. I know that's not necessarily what we were talking about, but it's not right to create a rule for that, you know, as it might be to, you know, try and create a rule that would limit shifts. But I don't know if you could create a rule that banned the opener and have it really be in the spirit of baseball. But I also don't think using the opener is in the spirit of a watchable game. It's not in this, like, I don't want to see some random freaking, I don't want to see Adam Morgan start a game. Why am I going? I don't care if Aaron Nola starts the next inning. I came to see Aaron Nola start a game. I didn't come to see Adam Morgan do it.
Yeah, no, I hear you. What got people more excited in the past couple of years than finding out, oh, it's going to be a bullpen game tonight? You know, that essentially was one step away from throwing in the towel. Like, I feel like I've never seen a game where the Phillies were like, it's a bullpen game tonight. We're just going to use a bunch of relievers. You know, guy who starts the game is going to go 2-3 innings most, and then we're just going to do like an inning a guy until the end of the game. I don't think I've seen a game like that the Phillies have like looked good playing, and they've most certainly lost, because it's not like the Phillies have had reliable bullpens in the past couple of years when they would have been doing that. But yeah, no, it's an interesting concept that I feel like, yeah, Gabe Kapler wants to try too much that we're not going to never see it. But don't worry, Liz, we're still safe back here in 2008 when the idea of the opener is a laughable offense mentioned in a bar late at night in the only the worst corners of Philadelphia. Meanwhile, the Phillies continued sucking against the NL East. It's not entirely true. They did take 2 of 3 from the Mets. In game one of the series, right after they lost a series to Washington, they went to New York. Greg Dobbs' home run was the difference in a 3-0 win in game one. Game two was canceled because of Hurricane Hannah. You remember that one? Me neither.
No, I was just going to say, did that happen? I'm just saying it, so I guess it did.
Yeah, Hurricane Hannah canceled game two, made it a doubleheader the next day. In that doubleheader, Jamie Moyer beat Pedro Martinez to start in the first game, and Cole Hamels lost to Johan Santana in the second game. That's pretty two marquee matchups, I guess you could say, as long as you forget that Jamie Moyer was the first name I said. But that's a pretty hysterical matchup, I would say, and just purely typical of the 2008 team. Liz, would you say the 2008 Mets were your least favorite Mets of recent memory?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Let me read some names.
Please do. I was just going to say, I know one name, but many
Jose
more.
Reyes, obviously.
Yeah, he sucks. Fuck
Luis
that guy.
Castillo, but he was more of a bumbling kind of guy than a outward insulting kind of guy. David Wright, Carlos Beltran, Ryan Church, Carlos Delgado. Brian Schneider got the most reps at catcher that year for them.
Wow.
Brian Schneider, not an easy guy to hate. But Daniel Murphy was 23 and on this team, played in 49 games for this team. Angel Pagan, Moises Alou was on this team.
Wow.
And he was only 41. Also, former Philly Abraham Nunez was on the Mets this year. You know, not as a key role player. I think he appeared in two games, but he was there. So I would say that no, this was not my least favorite Mets team. You know,
yeah. I was just gonna say, like, I can't. I have a hard time hating David Wright these days because he's around my age and struggling with being healthy,
being alive.
His career struggling with the Mets fucking him over, like the freaking penny pinching assholes that they are. You know, I can't hate Johan Santana because he went out in that blaze of glory. Daniel Murphy can go to hell, but is he Angel Pagan? I hate. I can't hate Carlos Beltran because Mets fans hate him so much. For no, like a lot of Mets fans hate him. Like two of my best friends are Mets fans. They freaking hate that guy. They hate him so much, and they don't really have a good reason. And so I've never been able to hate him because of that. You know, or Carlos Delgado. I know a lot of Mets fans can't stand that guy. Like, why? He just played for your team. Like, it's not, he played for one of your teams when they were even halfway decent. It's not like my hatred for Ty Wigginton, who sucked and also played on a sucky Phillies team.
You know, I hated Jeff Francoeur when he was on the Mets. And this
was not
the season he was on the Mets. He didn't join the Mets till 2009. And I hated him. I hated Paul LaDuca because Paul LaDuca was begging to be hated. And that was just,
yes,
those are the best, always, easiest, most fun players to hate. They weren't on the team at the same time. So that makes my decision harder. It's either like the 09 Mets or the 07 Mets. But yeah, that makes the 08 Mets kind of out of my crosshairs.
Yeah, I would agree. Like there are other Braves teams to hate. Like I like the ones in recent years that have made the Phillies, even when the Phillies were bad, it didn't, you know, they made just the Phillies weep. Like they brought them to their knees every single game. Like there's, I don't know, was it the past couple of years have been some really bad single game losses, series losses. I'm not even talking about that lopsided embarrassment of a baseball game from like last month. You know, like there were times when Cole Hamels would go out there and get hammered for no reason just because the Phillies were playing the Mets that day. Like those are teams, especially when they started getting more people with talent, like actual talent, you know, and started to think about being good. Like the 2015 Mets are pretty freaking hateable. You know, you've got Thor, you've got DeGrom, like you've got Harvey, you've got a lot of guys who are good and I hate for being good and being on the Mets and being part of that horrible organization, even though most of them don't have a choice.
Well, with that being said, we move on to the NL East team that I feel like that's the only NL East team that no Phillies fan I know has really strong feelings against. But again, a team they play 19, 20 times a year. I know people hate the Braves, people hate the Mets, people hate the Nationals. Marlins pretty much get off scot-free here. Phillies and Marlins have never really been great at the same time, obviously, so in our lifetime. So it's tough to really consider them a hated rival, but that's who the Phillies played next in their quest to lose to just about every NL East team. And they lost 2-3 to the Marlins. In game one, Ryan Howard, this game had a ton of weird offense. In game one, Ryan Howard had an RBI single to the pitcher in an 8-6 win, and the same game that Joe Blanton hit a sacrifice fly that knocked in Matt Stairs. What?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
how the 2008 Phillies won games. In game two, Kyle Kendrick pounded once again, this time by Dan Uggla and the gang. He gave up 7 runs, couldn't get out of the second inning. The Phillies made a valiant effort. They scored 4 runs in the sixth, couldn't make it work. Lost 10-8. Thank you, Kyle. Game three was a tie game until Josh Willingham knocked in a run with a fan-assisted ground rule double to make it 4-3. I realized later I couldn't find much on this. I don't know if it's fan-assisted, like the fan touched the ball so it became a ground rule double, or it was a home run and the fan messed it up and made it a ground rule double. It doesn't matter in either case because that double made it 4-3, and then the Marlins scored three more runs in the ninth inning anyway and won the game. But, you know, one of those scenarios helps the Phillies, one of them doesn't. But at the end of the day, Liz, what comes over people in a moment when they have a chance to catch a live ball? Because we judge these people very harshly, and I don't know if I'd be any different from them if I saw a ball coming at me. I really don't know. I've been to hundreds of baseball games in my life. The closest a baseball has ever come to me was only like a couple of weeks ago. I was at Camden Yards, and a foul ball landed at the seat in front of me. And I you know, you don't have time to react, I suppose. But in that case, when you're like watching the ball sail toward you, I feel like people just transform, and they suddenly go from like, hello, I'm a reasonable person, I have a job and I'm a reasonable person. And then suddenly they go to, if I don't have that baseball, I will kill all of my neighbors with a steak knife. And like, that's kind of like, I have no idea what comes over people. So what's your take on that situation?
I've had a handful of baseballs come close to me just in this past season at Fifth Third Field in Dayton at, I don't think any came near me. Oh no, one came near me at Citizens Bank Park, landed the next person over when I was with my dad. And I think one or two at Great American Ballpark at Cincinnati. And every time I reacted the same way, I curled up into a ball. I'm not kidding you. One of it was a couple of years ago. One came down a row behind me. You know, my fiance Sean stood up. He's real tall. He tried to get it. I, on the other hand, I curled up into a ball, tried to go into some kind of shell like a hermit crab. Like, I didn't want any part of it because I'm short. I do not play sports. I've never played sports. And so catching a ball is not only something that I'm going to be not likely to do because I'm so short, but I don't know if I'll be able to do it because I stink at that thing. I have terrible spatial recognition. My depth perception isn't awesome. Like, it's bad. So I understand sort of what can come over a person. What comes over me is an instant desire to protect myself from everything.
That's a good instinct. I think it'd be a hard time to argue with that. But yeah, no, that was the disaster of a stretch for the 2008 Phillies. Not their worst stretch, but certainly not one they wanted to have entering the final month of the season. Still a couple games back in the division. By the end of that Marlins series where they lost 2 out of 3, they were 3.5 games out of first place. And you know, it's September 10th. At that point, which that's coming down to the wire. That's comparable to this year. And I know we've drawn several comparisons from this team to the current team. But still, like, that's, you know, we know what happened to this team on like this year. 3.5 games left with half a month to play, just a little over half a month to play, that's coming down to the wire a little bit. But we're going to step with our remaining time. We're going to step even further back to 1993. Liz, if you think the NL East was different back in 2008, let me introduce you to the National League East in 1993, before the divisions had even realigned, which is something that younger fans might not even have realized was something that, I guess, the NL East in 1993, the Philadelphia Phillies were 46-31. They were playing, however, the NL East comprised of the Florida Marlins in their first season, the New York Mets, the Montreal Expos, the St. Louis Cardinals, the Chicago Cubs, and the Pittsburgh Pirates. That was the NL East back then. The Braves were in the West, which I forgot about. One of those ludicrous baseball alignment mysteries.
Oh, God. Oh, it feels like a million years ago, and none of that makes sense. I mean, I guess, you know, Pittsburgh could be anywhere, but honestly, that's so bizarre. Yeah. So bizarre.
So the Phillies in 1993, they went 9-4 against the Marlins, 10-3 against the Mets. And then against everybody else, they were pretty mediocre. 7-6 against the Expos, 8-5 against the Cardinals, 6-7 against the Cubs. They had a crappy time in Wrigley Field a couple of times. And 7-6 against the Pirates. So the 93 Phillies, yeah, they won 3 of 4 against the Cubs at Wrigley right around this time. Then they went to Cincinnati for 3 games. Then they lost 3 of 4 to the Cubs at home. So they just kind of swapped 4-game series victories with the Cubs right around now. Terry Mulholland strained a hip flexor and will be out for the month of September. And the Phillies acquired Don Paul, which anyone who read my – I already forgot about this. Earlier in the season, I wrote a series called Macho Low, which was about the lesser-known members of the 1993 team. And Don
– it was excellent. Go back and
Don
read
Don Paul
it.
Was one of my favorite entries to write because there were so many interesting facts about him. They called him the Pope because Don Paul sounds like John Paul, who was Pope at the time. His mom named him Don with two N's because she liked the name Don but didn't like the name Donald, so compromised by just saying Don with two N's, and that's your full real name. He was at the infamous Disco Demolition Night at Comiskey Park, at Old Comiskey Park. He loved Old Comiskey Park so much that a crew from This Week in Baseball was touring the stadium not long before it was going to be demolished in 1991, and they spotted him just like hanging out in the park because he was just like walking around saying goodbye to it by himself, just having like a nice time. And they found him. They were like, can you give us a tour? And he was like, okay. So he like showed him around the stadium because he's from Chicago. He was like this pure Chicago guy who like grew up loving the White Sox and then played for the White Sox in 1993 when they were going to the playoffs. Like, oh, it must be like a dream scenario for a kid like that. And then of course, my favorite part of the story is the Phillies like, they took all that away from him by trading for him and stole him out of Chicago, forced him to play in Philadelphia, traded him for their backup catcher. And then, both the White Sox and the Phillies suffered the same fate, losing to the Blue Jays in the postseason that year. So in either case, Don Paul can live on knowing that regardless if he had stayed in Chicago or not, the Blue Jays would have knocked him out of the playoffs regardless. So, but I bring up Don Paul not to just, pad my own stats, but also because in the book More Than Beards, Bellies, and Biceps about the 1993 Phillies by Bob Gordon and Tom Burgoyne, there's a passage that reads, Liz, all in all, middle relievers far surpassed expectations in 1993 and became a vital cog in the Phillies' attack. So, Liz, we're going to close here tonight talking about everybody's most, just the sexiest thing in baseball, middle relief pitching. Liz, let's start off. Liz, is it the worst playing job in baseball? Like, if you're a middle reliever, my thought is you didn't succeed at becoming a relief pitcher with a designated job. More likely, you're not a starting pitcher, because if you're a middle reliever, you're probably like a mop-up guy who's going to be asked to throw multiple innings in a game that is considered lost or won by a large margin. I mean, like, what even are the expectations for middle relievers at the start of a season? Aren't they just the pitchers who didn't succeed at getting one of the other jobs but weren't so bad that they didn't make the team?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the sexiest job. It's like you mentioned him earlier, like Chad Durbin is who we're talking about. Like, do you remember Chad Durbin? Maybe. Do you want to remember Chad Durbin? I don't know. Do you want to remember any? Do you want to remember middle relief ever? Like, they're just usually there. They're there when you don't want, when the pitcher doesn't go long enough, because ideally you want a pitcher to go seven innings. You have your setup man and then you have your closer. At least that's how it's always been done. Like middle relief, you see middle relievers when something not great is happening, usually.
Exactly. If you're a middle reliever and you're a hero, then you are an unsung hero. I can remember there was a game where Danny Baez threw like six innings and we were all blown away because he wasn't having the greatest season for the Phillies, but he came in a long game and threw like a bunch of innings and didn't let the other team
score. That was the Wilson Valdez game.
But like that, had to be.
I think that is the Wilson Valdez game and not as the holy shit Danny Baez did that game.
Something possibly more impressive than what Wilson Valdez did in that game. That might have been the same game David Herndon like had a pretty spectacular job holding the team the opposing team off the bases. Like that's what I mean about middle relievers. Like you don't go into the season thinking, all right, our middle relief core is really good. You're thinking like, all right, the back end of our bullpen is solid, the rotation's solid, the lineup is solid. And then if something bad happens, here are these other men who are on the team. It just feels like something you don't prepare to have. If you have any success with a middle reliever, it's because they're doing a good job, because they're like, maybe if I do a good enough job, I can have a better job on a different team. Like they're auditioning constantly, is my perception of that position. And guys like Don Paul, I mean, look, that's not saying they didn't play a vital role. They clearly did. A team that's going to middle relievers a whole lot probably isn't that great of a team, but if you find yourself doing that and your middle relievers actually come through for you, yeah, that's going to be an important role. It's just not a role that is supposed to be important. So I always talk about how bullpens are the most fickle component of any team season to season. They change so much. Even guys that, like, even if you have the same guys, they're not guaranteed to have the same kind of year they had next year. If you can have like three guys in your bullpen who are effective for like 3 years, that's a hell of a bullpen. And middle relievers, I feel like, are the most transient of the bunch. So to be able to say you have a solid middle relief, I mean, that's a pretty niche role to fill. And obviously, you know, 1993 Phillies having the success they had, you have little sections of your team come through that aren't necessarily supposed to come through. That's what good teams are comprised of. You know, those are we always talk about. Oh, it's the little acquisitions that change everything. And look, the Phillies acquired Don Paul in September of 1993, and he wound up catching the last out of the game that clinched them a playoff berth. So, you know, push comes to shove, that's the kind of moves you got to make. But yeah, middle relief, not something that I think a lot of guys set out to be like, I'm going to be the middle reliever on this team. Like, I don't want to start. I don't want to close this game. I want to be the guy they turn to when they are down by 9 runs in the third inning. That's been my fantasy since I was a kid. I had Don Paul's poster on my wall.
Yeah, no one wants that. No one, you know, middle relief. I mean, I say this pretty much every year. You can create a bullpen out of nothing. You can create a bullpen out of just the dudes that are out there. And that's what middle relief usually is. It's the dudes who are out there. Remember when the Phillies signed David Herndon to an actual contract? I think they signed him for like 2 years. I remember thinking, wow, they must really like him. He's a, you know, he's the middle reliever and, you know, they want him to stay around. This is a big deal, you know, and that he was gone because he stunk. You know, I remember when they brought Chad Durbin back to be a middle reliever several years after 2008. He stunk and he was gone. Like, oh God, Chad Qualls. Like, these dudes, you pick them up, they work, they don't work, you discard them. The Phillies haven't done a lot of that this year. I'm actually kind of surprised. They've really just stuck with who they've had and gone through the problems. You know, 3 cheers for Hector Neris.
Yeah, I actually wrote a quick thing. I had some spare Hector Neris notes I turned into an article for The Good Fight today that was just about how he kind of epitomizes what the 2018 season was supposed to be about. Like, you and I, and I mentioned this in the article, you and I and John are always talking about when a guy is having a rough stretch, a young player is having a rough stretch. You know, this is what development looks like. That's become our mantra. But Hector Neris, that's what development looks like. It's just not the ugly part. It's the part that he struggled. He lost his job. He was sent away to like readjust, retool, and recalibrate. And he came back and he won the National League Relief Pitcher of the Month for the month of August. Like, that's really impressive. That's what 2018 was for guys like that to solidify what role or a role moving forward. And by doing so by showing that they can be effective. And then they can also struggle and figure out how to be effective again. Like, that's development. That's kind of like getting over the humps. That's improvement. And that's what this season to me was supposed to be about.
Yeah. I nothing makes me happier than Hector Neris figuring it out, being sent to the minors, which is what a struggling dude is supposed to do. You're supposed to do that for him, you know? And I think maybe if JP Crawford had been around, it could have been a possibility with Scott Kingery, but that's clearly to me what he needed. But they sent Hector Neris down. He figured his shit out. He came back and now he's effective. Like, that's how baseball is supposed to work for good players or players with talent. Because if you have the talent, it's a matter of just figuring out, all right, where did it go? It's around here somewhere. I just have to figure out how to bring it out again. You know, and that's a lesson that everyone needs to learn on the Phillies, clearly.
Correct. Yes. Well, that is all the time we have on continued success this week. Please join us next week. We're going to talk about, obviously, whatever Phillies thing has stuck in our crawl next week. But at the same time, we'll also talk about 28 Phillies. 2008 Phillies got super hot in mid-September. This was kind of when they that was their moment. There was like a week and a half in mid-September where they pretty much solidified that they were the team of the season, certainly the best team in the NL East. And the 1993 Phillies were average at best in that same stretch. So we'll talk about both of those things, whatever's on our minds about the 2018 Phillies as well. As usual, don't forget to tune into Hittin' Season with John Stolness. At the round table Hittin' Season that's recorded on Sunday nights is also with John Stolness, myself, and Liz, who you just had the pleasure of listening to in this podcast. And of course, the Dirty Inning with myself and Trevor Strunk. We talk about the dumbest innings in Phillies history, and we have a lot of fun doing it. There'll be a new episode of that coming this week as well. So
yes, and those of you who are on Patreon, stay tuned. We're in the middle of sort of retooling our Patreon tiers and rewards and such. So if you're interested, now is a great time to get on board, but it will also be a great time after we do that. So think about becoming a patron of Hittin' Season.
Yes, please. The lowest tier will be $5, and you'll get you'll have access to all kinds of good extra exclusive content just by throwing $5 in our direction, which we appreciate. So thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.
I'm Michael Kist of Bleeding Green Nation, and I invite you, gentle listener, to join us for the best analysis of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles in the business. BGN Radio provides you with the most informative preview shows, and the Kist and Solak show dives deep into all the scheme and X and O details you could ever want. Plus discussions with the industry's brightest minds, including former NFL players, and press conferences from the Eagles coaching staff to keep you up to date and informed every step of the way. Subscribe to Bleeding Green Nation today. Fly, Eagles, fly.